Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. Gosh, my voice is a little weak today, just a little coldy. I hope you all are in a little better health than me, or a lot better health, but I'm in good health. I am doing good. I'm going to be 83 years old next month. Oh, my Lord in heaven. How did it happen? How have I been blessed to live this long and to still be talking to my wonderful audience and to my family and to be writing and to be traveling and doing all the things I'm doing and trying to stand up for truth and speak truth to power. It's a good thing. Just took a nice walk with my wife in our lovely little neighborhood, and things are good. And I hope things are good with you too as spring begins. This is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and you're listening to it on PRN.FM. And this is a call-in show. You can call in at 888-874-4888. And we really do want to have you today talking with us about some extremely unusual and important issues that rarely get raised. And one of the big ones is, what are we doing to our male children? What are we doing to our boys, and then to our young men, and then to our future generations? My guest is Jeannie Stolzer. Jeannie is a dear friend. His last name is spelled S-T-O-L-Z-E-R. She's a dear friend. Been on the show before. And she's of wide ranging interests over psychology, child development, the issues of women in America and in the world today and historically. Issues of neurobiology, and she's gotten deeply interested in the negative effects of psychoactive drugs. She's at the University of Nebraska in Kearney, Nebraska, and she has a PhD and teaches child development and family, and writes a variety of interesting articles. Jeannie, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Dr. Breggin.
Hi, please, Peter. We're Peter and Persenden on the air. Jeannie, how do I sound? It's a little tinny on my end. Does it sound good on your end?
I think you sound good.
Okay, great. Jeannie, I want to do a little more introduction to my program, but also to you as we go along. Jeannie is going to be the latest recipient of the Research Award, the Honorary Researcher Award. And she asked me, how do I describe the award? Well, it could be either from Dr. Breggin or from ICSPP. And it's the Honored Researcher Award. And ICSPP is the International Association for Patient-Oriented Psychiatry. We're also the Empathic Therapy Association. So we go under two names depending on what point we're trying to make at the time. And if you want to email me, it's at Breggin Live at Hotmail.com. I continue to get a lot of interesting queries. I will answer some of them, not all of them. And I'm always glad to hear from you. And it's just a pleasure to be here. Now, don't forget, there's an app that you can carry with you anywhere in your phone and listen to the show. And the call in again is 888-874-4888. And don't forget that the best way to stay in touch with me is to get the free frequent alerts at Breggin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N. And the frequent alerts are very much at the heart of our website. It makes it active and daily, almost daily. And then we have our daily breaking news. My assistant Ian gives me all kinds of interesting new information. And sometimes I put up information and Ginger does. But today I saw something that Ian put up. And the Drug Administration has now developed a new drug for ADHD. It turns out when you look at what it is, it's good old methylphenidate. It's called Adhansia. How about that for clever? Adhansia. And Adhansia is just it's just a large dose of methylphenidate. It's got nothing special about it. What's really special is that it's put out by Purdue Pharma. Purdue Pharma is a company that's got thousands of lawsuits against it for OxyContin, been in all kinds of problems and troubles for the marketing of OxyContin. And look at this great lesson they've learned. I guess the lesson is that with all the aggravation and supposed near bankruptcy, it's still best to just sock them with a good solid dose of an addictive drug. And Ritalin is highly addictive, and it's pretty much exactly the same addiction as amphetamines, Adderall that we give our kids. And it does lead to an increased rate of abuse of cocaine and other stimulants in adulthood. This would happen if you were simply a little rat growing up and you were given some. You'd be more likely to choose it in adulthood. And same thing happens to people because it's a physical phenomena where your brain adapts to this. And so stay with us with our breaking news, with all the good stuff in it, and stay with us with our frequent alerts. And I'm so glad you're there. Jeannie, we had talked on the phone about all kinds of interesting things. And I'd just like to turn it over to you to talk about, if you want, just continue this conversation about just what's happening to children. You've got several good articles about it. They'll be going up as we get up your page as an honored researcher. And people will be able to just go there and read your stuff. I've actually ordered the PDFs of them. So we'll have some really good PDFs of these articles. But to pitch in and just talk for a while about your thoughts about what's happening to our boys today.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the new drug that's being marketed because, in my opinion, and in my scientific research, we're headed toward lunacy. I mean, we're headed the wholesale medicalization of maleness. I mean, that's what we're doing. And I wanted to say one more thing before I get on the track of just specifically boys. Methylphenidate, according to the Drug Enforcement Agency, not my research, it's the Drug Enforcement Agency, is stating unequivocally that cocaine and methylphenidate, i.e. Ritalin, are neuropharmacologically the same exact drug with the same exact effects. That's our DEA. And this is what we're giving to two-year-old boys, five-year-old boys? It's insanity. We're on a path to insanity.
It is. And, you know, and it's very, very close to cocaine, very, very close, and very close to methamphetamine. They're a little stronger. They have more punch, a little shorter acting, but they're all the same class of drug, and take one, and you're going to be encouraged by your brain and body to take one of the others.
Yep. So when your DEA comes out and issues this kind of statement, you better know they're serious, and this is a very serious classification of drugs. But with regard to the boyhood issue that's happening in our country, I think we can all agree that throughout the centuries, females have had a very difficult time. They couldn't vote. They couldn't own property. They could be abused. I mean, everybody knows it. It's true. But the assumption today in modern-day America, and we're just talking about America, that females are at a distinct disadvantage, particularly in institutions like education and the workforce. And the statistics just don't bear that out for the last 25 years. They simply don't. I mean, females are more likely to graduate with a degree, and I'm talking about any type of degree, from a high school diploma to an associate's degree to a bachelor's degree to a PhD to a JD to an MD. And they're much more likely to attend college and to graduate from college. It's, our boys are really, really the ones who are languishing right now, and nobody's willing to talk about it. I think it's so off our politically correct script that we're sort of afraid to talk about this. And I talk about it a lot, and I do a lot of research in this area. So I'm one of those outliers that will talk about it, and I know it makes people uncomfortable, but it needs to be talked about. It simply does.
Well, let's hear some more about it, Jeannie. What do you feel education's doing to young boys now? And we'll also talk about the diagnoses and ADHD and family life and so on, but let's kind of dig in deeper into what's happening to the boys in our educational system, attitudes of teachers, and so on.
Okay, well, let's start off first with who are the teachers in our country. And as we all know, they're predominantly female. Females view male behavior with a much different lens than males view male behavior. That needs to be said first off. We also need to talk about something critical in this arena, and that is that for the first time in recorded history over the last 20, 25 years, teachers in our public school system are now becoming brokers for the pharmaceutical industry by referring all these children on for psychiatric diagnoses. I went to school in a public school in America, and that was unheard of. Teachers weren't neurologists or psychiatrists or psychologists. They were teachers. So those are two really, really, really important points when we start wanting to examine the medicalization of boyhood in America. There used to be a debate when I was in grad school. God, that's a long time ago. When I was in grad school, there was this huge debate going on about gender. And one side of the debate would say that gender is merely a social construct. You know, it's a social construct. It can be recalibrated at will. It's, you know, manufactured by society. And the other side, the more bioevolutionary side, would say, no. It's our bioevolutionary heritage. Gender is not socially constructed. And they fought and they fought and they hated each other until the advent of neuroimaging studies, the CAT, the PET, the MRI. We know now for a scientific fact the majority of male and female brains are extraordinarily different. Now, of course, there's always outliers. There are female brains that look very male, and there are male brains that look very female, and they're fine. That's okay. They're just outliers. The norm is they're very, very different in particular areas, the prefrontal lobes, the frontal lobes, the basal ganglia. Even the pituitary gland is operating different. That fight or flight response, is much more engaged in males. And we don't want to talk about this because we want to say that there are no neurological correlates here. And the fact is, there are many neurological correlates here. So that has to be talked about. It simply does. Boys and girls are different. I mean, they're really different. They're emotionally different. Psychologically, they're different. Physiologically, they're different. They learn different, they input different, they output different, they problem solve different, they're neurologically and hormonally, they're different in every way. And that flies in the face of this feministic behavioristic theory that's permeating our institutions of higher learning, and that's what our teachers are being taught.
That's it's like we're ignoring evolution. I mean, very, very clearly, men and women adapted That is, they responded to the environment, and different genetic advantages were found for being a woman and for being a man in terms of human survival. So you have men being physically, in general, stronger, more aggressive, physically more aggressive at least. And you have women built for nurturing. They're softer, their shoulders and breasts are built for nurturing infants. And this is, this is so obvious. Why would one have to bring it up? It doesn't mean that a male or female has to be locked in someplace, but it does tell you a lot about how the human race, the human beings, how we evolved in order to grow and to survive. And I think we at least need to look at that and understand that before we throw it all away as if it's just all oppression of women, you know, end story.
You're bringing up such an important point. We have completely and totally thrown out of the equation bioevolutionary psychology. It's not there anymore. We don't discuss it because people will jump down your throat. And we have facts. We have science on our hands with neuroimaging. Really, we do. And we have science on our hands with testosterone. It is simply a biological fact that testosterone increases aggressiveness, territorialness, competitiveness. It just does. And you can wish it wasn't true. You can do all this, but it is true. And it's true across all cultures, across all mammals, and across historical time. I think one of the things we did, I think we've got two words confused. I think that may be at the root of all of this, and that is sameness and equality. Of course, we're all equal. We're human beings. We should be afforded the same rights to education and land ownership and to go into any profession and blah, blah, blah. But we're not the same. We're not. We have very, very different strengths. Very different strengths. Again, there's always outliers, and they're beautiful and they're fine. They're just not the norm. We can't have this discussion without talking about economics. I mean, look at the people who are making money on the medicalization of maleness. I mean, the list is so long, I don't even know if we have time to talk about it. All the pharmaceutical companies are making hand over fist money with this. The schools are, as they get monies for each individual child who's labeled. And let's be honest, let's just talk about stats. 90% of our SPED kids, our special education kids, are male. That includes all psychiatric disorder, behavioral disorders, learning disorders. These are little boys. And our schools are making money. Yes, they are. All these trained SPED teachers. I mean, look at the money that's being made here. And none of these things existed in earlier generations. There was no such thing as SPED when you were in school. No such thing as SPED when I was in school. Of course, there were better readers than others, or some people were better at math, but you didn't see yourself as learning disordered or learning disabled. You just thought you weren't so hot in math. And the great news about it is if you worked harder in those days, you could get better. But now you carry on your back this label that you are learning disabled. It's the worst thing we can do to kids. It absolutely is the worst thing we can do to children, to rob them of their agency, to rob them of self-efficacy. And us as adults are placing labels on learning disabled. What does that mean? Well, it means we're watching this steady decrease of males in institutions of higher learning where I teach every day. Graduation's in 3 weeks. And we're going to see what we see every year for the last 15 years, and that is a whole bunch of females graduating. And, of course, there'll be pockets of males in industrial technology and construction management. But when you look across the whole auditorium, you're going to see females predominantly. That's where we're at in America. Nobody's questioning it.
Is that true throughout the educational system? Now, your school is a state school.
Yes,
right?
That's true.
And I remember when I went into the cafeteria with you, and the first time we met, we were having such a good time meeting each other. And
I looked around and I said, Jeannie, don't you have any boys in this school? Do you have any young men? It was startling how few there were. What are the actual statistics, as best as you can give them from some examples or some national facts? I don't have any data here in front of me.
I haven't looked at it for a year or two, but you can go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and you can find out what they are for 2018. For 2017, there's something like this. I can say this with scientific certainty. Females are significantly more likely to graduate from high school and university, whether they're private or, and I think it's 64, I'm not going to quote stats, but it's significantly higher that females are holding degrees than males. Not only are they entering college at much higher rates than males, they're actually being awarded degrees at higher rates than males. That's a fact all across this country. And so I've been asked before, and I actually wrote a paper on it, well, why? I mean, people have written about the discrepancies and what's happening to males, but they're not delving into why our males are not going to college. And to me, it's very simple. When you tell a little boy at Head Start when he's 3 years old, or in kindergarten when he's 5 years old, that he has ADHD and or a learning disability, why in the hell would that boy grow up to think that he could be successful at a university? You pound it into his head for the last 12 years that he's disordered. And now he believes it. This is a travesty. What are we doing? And since sociological research shows us that women tend to marry up, meaning education-wise, and money-wise, who are these women with PhDs and master's degrees going to be marrying? I mean, this has long-term effects. Good questions to ask. Politically explosive, I understand, but good questions nonetheless.
Yeah, I grabbed some statistics off of Google, and 56% of students on campuses nationwide are women. Some over 2 million fewer men than women will be enrolled in college this year. The Atlantic has an article back in 2017, Why Men Are the New Minority in College. So things are changing, and I wonder what it's like in the Ivy League. I have no idea about that, and I don't want to spend much time Googling. I'll lose my concentration on your amazing discussions. Do you feel like I do that there's a general, God, I hate to use this old laden word, but I won't use the old word, but a general knocking down of boys, just a general pushing them into a cookie cutter they don't fit in, and really making them feel relatively impotent.
Well, yes. Like I just said, when you're labeled, when you're 4, 5, 6, with a psychiatric illness called ADHD or conduct disorder or oppositional defiance, and you're learning disabled, I mean, what better way to dismantle a person? You rob them of all their agency. And you're seeing the effects now. I mean, it took a while, but here we go. And I really do want to ask the question, who are women going to marry? Because women tend to marry up. So we're awarding all these master's degrees and PhDs to females. Who are they going to marry? And what's going to happen to our culture? Are women
and
just
then we get, of course, into down? What's happening to the family around these boys. And it's also happening to the girls, where very often the boys are being primarily raised by a mom, which raises all kinds of conflicts as they don't go through that natural transition from being closest to mom to then aspiring to be more like dad, which, I mean, you're the developmental psychologist. That's a natural tendency, isn't it?
Well, I think it depends on what theory you're coming off of, and you're coming off of Freudian theory, and of course Freud talks.
That's terrible. I'm not coming. I thought I was coming off of general observations and common sense. You've never insulted me before, Jamie. Is that Freudian theory? It could have been Adlerian. It could have been my observations. But what's the truth? You're good. Tell us, what's the truth about how boys develop in terms of their moms and dads? Or is there no general theme?
Well, there is, but it absolutely depends on what theory you're springing off of. And I did not mean to insult you, but Freud absolutely insisted that in order for healthy developmental processes to occur, the same-sex parent must be in the home. So as you were saying, little boys have to have their father in the home. Now, Bowlby, who was a Freudian, there's no doubt about it, but then went on to study ethology, he absolutely went the opposite of Freud in this area and said it doesn't matter if it's a mother or a father. What matters is a secure attachment. Bowlby didn't care if the primary attachment was
a I think penis. That's right. I take back what I said earlier. It was antiquated. Yes, I think it's attachment. It's having somebody to love and support you and be there for you and to be a consistent person. And who's going to be there in the modern society is a very serious issue. I know this is going to be hard for a lot of my wonderful listeners because this gets into really complicated issues around things that we've assumed we can break down with impunity. But, if this, your child doesn't have someone who's consistent and loving and present, it could be somebody you bring in the home for 4 or 5 years. It could be grandma, grandpa. It could be mom, could be dad. But doesn't all the research show that children need at least one familiar person consistently being in their lives to help them grow up? And that, in fact, ruptures of that in wartime and in the death of a parent and so on is very hard on the children in the first few years of their life. Is that all true? Because you really know more about this than I do.
One of his most famous quotes is that, and I can quote it, is baby mammals need their mother or permanent mother substitute if optimal developmental processes are to occur. And he was, oh my God, was he battered for saying that, but it's such a fact. It is such a fact. And the feminist jumped him and said, how can you put all of this on a mother? Well, because across cultures, across mammals, and across time, it usually is mother who's the primary attachment. It doesn't have to be. As you so eloquently stated, it can be grandma. It can be dad. It can be an adoptive mother or father. But typically, it's mother. And Freud did agree with that, so Bowlby was pulling from Freud when he said the mother is the most critical and paramount and cardinal relationship we'll ever have. Some people argue vehemently against that, too, but that's why theory is so important here. But we do know for optimal development to occur, a consistent, loving, committed adult that's viewed as better able to cope with the world is in that child's life, and they feel secure. Bowlby called this a secure base over and over again. I'm okay. The world's up topsy-turvy out there, but I've got this secure base. I'm going to be okay.
It turns on its head the accepted saying that it takes a village to raise a child. In fact, every experiment in that direction, including the Israeli kibbutzes, indicated that it's not a village raising a child. That does not work. It takes a village to support the parents, parents in the raising of their children.
Yeah, but it's a nice statement, and it got a lot of play, but it's simply not true. It takes a secure attachment. Bowlby wouldn't be so politically correct. He would say it takes a committed and stable mother, and then later he changed that to a primary attachment person. But yes, that's what a child needs. I think one of the best ways to illustrate his findings, I know you've seen this because it's just so amazing. In England in the 1940s, when the Germans were bombing the holy heck out of London, they sent their children all out in the country because the countryside wasn't being bombed. So they sent their children out with strangers and to keep them safe. Well, some parents in England at the time said, are you crazy? No. But the parents had to work. So, long, long story short, this is Bowlby's work. Those children who stayed in bomb-ravaged London with their secure base did much better emotionally, psychologically, over the next 30 years than those children who were out of harm's way with regard to the bombs who were with strangers. If that doesn't illustrate attachment theory, I don't know what does. The children who were bombs were raining down on did better in the next 30 to 40 years psychologically because they were with their secure base. It's something to think about, but it also is a really scary thing because the majority, 77% of our infants are not with their secure base for the majority of their time. They're with an uninvested stranger at a daycare. That's where they are. And our policies fuel into that. So we're in a hell of a mess in this country is what's going on.
Yeah, we're not telling women what they need to do for their own freedom and their own lives. But we do have to be honest about this and also about the nursing issue, which is how important nursing is. And it shouldn't be any surprise. We evolved over 2 or 3 million years, wherever you want to call the starting point of two-leggeds. And we evolved with being nursed by parents while we were old enough to walk around and begin feeding ourselves and playing with other children. It wasn't a two-month affair or a three-month affair. I think, Jeannie, you really taught me the most about that, about these studies and how much they show that before modern times, nursing went on for years and years.
Absolutely, it does. And it does all mammals. I mean, it's a critical component of the mother-child bond. And so many people in modern-day America see breastfeeding as just nutrition. And of course it's fabulous nutrition. I mean, there's no doubt about that. It's the best nutrition an infant or a child could ever have. But it cements the bonding process. God or nature or whatever you think it is made it so skin-to-skin contact was essential and eye contact. There's the beginnings of the secure base right there. And I know we don't like to talk about it, and we do so many things in our hospitals to make sure that breastfeeding doesn't get off to a good start. For example, we drug the mother during birth so the letdown reflex doesn't occur. When she's pumped up with drugs, that cocktail of hormones that needs to occur in the maternal body for breastfeeding to commence can't because she's under the influence of so many drugs. And then we take the baby away and put the baby in a nursery. I mean, try this with kittens. Drug the hell out of the mother when she's giving birth so she can't have a letdown reflex and won't produce milk. And then take the baby kittens away from her and see how well the breastfeeding relationship is established with the mother cat. We're going the wrong way. I mean, I know we think we're so high-tech and we've made such strides, and we have in some areas. But in other areas, we're really going backwards.
Yeah, we get so arrogant. I remember one of my professors in med school in the 60s saying that we could perfectly reproduce mother's milk, and there was no reason for parents to mothers to nurse. And just recently at one of my joint conferences that I put on with Pam Popper, well-known person to my listeners, I hope by now, one of the conferences, I heard a lecture that was in part about the responsiveness of the mother's immune system, even practically minute by minute, to the threats in the environment, and how that is then, though antibodies made are then passed through the mother's milk to the infant who doesn't have a strong enough immune system to necessarily produce those antibodies. So in other words, the mother and her reactivity to the environment and her ability to produce her own antibodies becomes the antibody machine for the child in the specific environment they're in together. And this makes sense. All of this makes sense. And Now, again, I'm not telling anyone you're bad for making one choice or another. I mean, I think about, my choices I made in regard to getting divorced. You know, I did it for myself, thinking that, everybody gets divorced, the kids do fine. Well, they don't. So you'll know I'm not putting some load on other people that I don't put on myself. There was no way that I should have taken the decision to have children as if I wouldn't have to always be in the house. We learn, we grow, but I think it's so important to face that there are consequences to different decisions. And in my case, I'm glad my kids are all of them are alive. It would have been better as a principle to wait a lot longer to get married until I was really ready to be married for the rest of my life and been there with, somebody whom I loved and loved me, and we supported this family. But I took marriage very cavalierly when I got married in the 60s. Not that I didn't take the person seriously, but I didn't view marriage as a something that would have, that was that big a commitment to a lifetime. It's more like an experiment. And I want to say that because I'm not trying to hold other people to a different standard. I'd say we have to learn from what we now know about parenting and its importance in all ways.
For me, science, I'm a scientist, and I don't worry about guilt. Science to me is just science. And if you notice for example, with the nicotine, the cigarette research, we didn't stop doing research on the hazards associated with cigarettes, emphysema, lung cancer, stroke, heart, because it was making people feel guilty. We kept on because those are scientific facts. The same is true, and I'm so glad you brought up the antibodies and things like that with the breastfeeding. I've been doing research in this area for decades, publishing it. It is a scientific fact that mothers produce antibodies based on her environment. And if her baby's sharing that environment with her, the mother gives those antibodies, live antibodies, to her baby. Those are just simple facts. It's not about making people feel guilty. It's just a scientific fact. And we have to stop this pretending that if you formula feed or breastfeed, it's just sort of like, are they going to wear a yellow or a green sweater? It has lifelong consequences, but this is not a women's. We can't, disparage women. If we're going to disparage somebody, let's disparage the healthcare providers who aren't trained in this area, who are giving erroneous and false information to women and handing them samples of formula. That's where we need to go with this.
Yeah, we need to change the society. You know, I've always been a small government person, which I'm sure again, some of my listeners, I'm sure, love me despite this. But, I mean, I don't think there's any question that we've got to have extensive family leave for parents, for the primary parent, extensive in order to raise happier, sounder, stronger, more able to love children. I don't think there's any doubt about it because the current society with two working parents doesn't come close to meeting the needs for one of them to stay home. And it just isn't going to happen that way. And I think we need to have maybe on a state level, maybe just as grants to parents when they have a child, which happens in other countries. We have to make provision for a primary parent to say, I'm going to raise my children for a considerable period of time. I don't want to name an amount of time because I just don't know where to begin, because we're looking at a really difficult political and economic problem. But I think it would just add immensely to the strength of the family and of children growing up to do that.
Well, one way we can do it, we can fund it, is the way other countries do it. And according to the Surgeon General of the United States, if we breastfed exclusively for 6 months, just 6 months, we would save $3.5 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars a year in health care costs alone. If we breastfed just exclusively, just for 12 months, according to the Surgeon General, we would save $7 billion a year in health care costs. So that $7 billion a year could ensure a whole bunch of Americans. And I kind of cringe that I live in a country that can spend $4.2 billion on a new ship, on a new destroyer, but we cannot seem to find a way to pay maternity leave. It's upsetting to me, and it lets me know as a child developmentalist just exactly where our children are on the priority list.
Our children have become just a marketplace. I mean, that's where they are on the priority list. What can we market to kids? Drugs, you know, seductive clothing, violent and sexual entertainment, ADHD. I mean, it's, they're marketing. That's what they are. More and more clear to me. I'm talking about it and thinking about it more and more. They're a marketplace, and they are not cherished. They are not encouraged to think of themselves, as responsible beings who can grow up and learn to make choices and become members of a relatively free society. They're not even taught about taking responsibility in society. I don't think that's taught anymore. Let's go to boys again.
I want to say this before I forget. I know this is true. Throughout evolutionary time, our boys haven't changed a bit. The boy that was that's 4 years old right now in central Nebraska is the exact same as the boy who was born 7,000 years ago. I mean, boys haven't changed. What's changed is our cultural perception of boyhood. That's what's changed. They haven't changed a bit. We are writing new scripts that this is a disorder, and that is pathological, and this constitutes a disability. What are we doing? Look at what we're doing. It's our boys. And then you have the American Psychological Association coming out with a quote that masculinity is harmful. Masculinity is harmful? What are you talking about? It's so unbelievable that I've lived this long to see this kind of lunacy. And it's pervasive.
Well, it comes out of what began, I think, is such an important analysis, which was the feminist analysis of patriarchy. And yep. That has really educated me and helped me understand the issues of the oppression of women and children and of men over other men. And there's no doubt that has been a great issue through evolution. And I think it can be explained through evolution how that occurred. It doesn't mean it was a good thing, but how that evolved, because it's something that grew beyond evolution. Evolution was families, extended families. It was very hard to bully people or have a dictator because you could pick up your bow and your arrow and your kids and your wife. And if you were a male or a female, and you could just go off by yourselves for a while and fish and forage, and then find another group of people who wanted somebody to join them. So you couldn't have these overwhelming institutions that we had once we started raising crops and goats and sheep and whatever else, and living close together and becoming very, very dependent on each other, and setting up institutions that then could be taken over by people. So patriarchy really is a sort of an outcropping of the success of human evolution when we started going into communities, but we weren't prepared to live that way, and we're still struggling with it. I think we're still struggling with it. Say some more about this ridiculous thing going on with APA. They're working on, this is the Psychological Association. They can be as crazy as the psychiatric.
I wanted to say this before I forget, though, about what you just said. True patriarchy begins with the Industrial Revolution. And what I mean by that, just think about this for a second. Throughout evolutionary time, males and females had very divergent scripts. Females were the nurturers and the carers, and they were the gatherers. You know, they had all these things they had to do. They were responsible for the upbringing of the children, and males were responsible for the hunting and the building. Okay, so you had these two people. Everything that was done within the familial sphere. Everything. And they knew unequivocally if one of them dropped out, for example, if the dad dropped out and there was no more hunter, the family was in really bad trouble. Or if the mother dropped out and there was no more nurturer or gatherer or basket weaver, the family was in really bad trouble. They both knew that, and that's why they relied so heavily on each other. With the advent of the Industrial Revolution, what happens is the male goes to work. He leaves the family sphere, and now he makes money, and now he becomes the patriarch. That's when the dichotomy of this public and private spheres begins. Because before that, they were both essential to the family. And he goes out and becomes the worker and controls the money. Before that, there was no money. So,
I'm just listening because I just want you to continue discussing all of this. It's, you're not going to hear this discussion hardly anywhere. For one thing, it takes some really broad interests to think about these things. You have to have been interested in economics and sociology and psychology and biology and evolution, and you have to have had a certain bit of a willingness to look beyond your ideology. Certainly, my view of what we are as human beings really changed as I talked with people so closely in therapy, and as I began to read about relationship and how relationship was a key to human life, and that's where Bowlby had a big influence on me, attachment theory. It was very interesting, folks. when I first met Jeannie, she asked me, Who's been a big influence on you? And she still laughs about my answer. I'd never thought about this answer before, but I said, this is, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I'm not sure. I said, I've been Peter Bregan for a long time. Well, Jeannie's had a very big influence on me in terms of reminding me and then further educating me about attachment theory. I did a huge amount of reading on my own in high school and in college, and I read Bowlby, not because he was assigned in school, attachment theory. I read him because I found him, and he was so important, and as an anthropologist. I mean, I never even thought of him as a Freudian or a psychoanalyst. I always thought of him as an anthropologist, And that's what he did, and that's what what he learned from was the study of relationships, both as a therapist and as a an anthropologist. And so Jeannie really gave me a lot in that regard. And it's interesting that Jeannie and has had such a big influence on me, and you all know how much Pam Popper has had a big influence on me. And it's all within the last 10 years, taking me into deeper roots, into good health and nutrition with Pam, and into my roots that I lost track of during my education of the human relationships and attachment theory. And then, of course, Ginger Bregan, with most of you know, who's also had such a big influence on me. But that's been going on for 35 years. We influence each other, and it's a good thing.
We do. What are we going to do about this boy crisis, Peter Bregan? What are we going to do? We've got to do something. We're losing a whole generation of boys, and my fear is it's going to go on through the generations. What are we going to do? I mean, I've got ideas, but I want to hear yours. What do you think we should do? We're involved in this demasculinization of males, and it's not just little boys.
I think one of the first things that we have to do, and this is so difficult to talk about, is that we have to be willing to lose some friends. We have to be willing to stand up on issues that some people are going to misunderstand or will find genuinely threatened because it implies ways of life that don't fit with how we've been trained to think and to feel. I think we have to find that courage to speak and to write more and more about this. And you're such an eloquent speaker about it. And again, folks, I've got so much into this that I didn't even mention Jeannie's name again, really. But it's Jeannie Stolzer, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R. And you can find her easily on the website. She's from Nebraska. University of Nebraska professor out there. You know, we've got to be addressing it more and more. And I've been going more and more. It's funny, the older I get, the more I want to protect children, the more I want to let people have a good start. And so the more and more I'm thinking that I'm going to be addressing children. And I've called for professionals to start taking seriously banding together to come out for a ban on giving psychoactive substances to children to control their behavior and their mental life. We didn't do this before. I mean, this is such a new phenomenon. It shouldn't be radical to say, let's not do this. The radicalness comes in the numbers of industries that will be threatened, the number of professions that will be threatened, how teachers will have to learn to manage their children, how parents will have to assume that they have the ability to bring up their kids and not drug them into submission. But I think we need to take strong stands about these issues. But we're going to get a lot of flack. I mean, you've already gotten a lot of flack about the stands you've been taking. I think if I was in a university, I would be too, talking about these issues. And I want to give folks out there courage. I want to give my wonderful audience courage to say, yeah, there are differences biologically between men and women. It's rather obvious. Their shapes are different. Their different shapes are for very specific purposes. In addition to attracting each other, they have great purposes in terms of what they provide to infants, the very different kinds of things that they have through evolution provided to the young, the male providing protection and the building, as you said, of things and hunting. And since human beings have always been violent with each other, the males in your particular band or extended family had to protect you from other human beings, as well as from animals, and that job fell mainly to the men, and the women provided more of the calories than the men did through their, in most societies, much more calories, by going out and taking the risks of foraging and being out together and bringing the kids with them and bringing them up along the way and raising them and carrying them. So we know what went on, and it's fine for individuals to have all the freedom in the world to adopt any gender they want or any approach they want, as long as they're not harming other people to their lives. But we also have to look socially and culturally at what have we evolved to be, and if we're going to change that, what are we going to do about that, and how? And what does bring the most satisfying life? Is it more, and I ask this as a question, I've never asked it before, and I don't know if I have an answer, but is it more satisfying to find out who we are evolutionary-wise and try to be the person, the creature, the animal, and the being, and the spiritual person that we evolved to be? So these are all, wow, big questions. I hope some of you will write in to me at my email for the radio show, BreganLive@hotmail.com. And give me some feedback on the show today. This show has been very interesting in that we have not had any callers, but we have a very significant audience that has grown over the time of the show. I suspect, and maybe some of you could just send me a note and say, yeah, that's what it was. I think people were so interested in this that they didn't want to call on the phone and interrupt. But let me know. I don't remember another show in recent time where we haven't had callers. We certainly have had a growing audience over the period of time we've been here. And I think we're probably going to get a big follow-up on archives on Bregan.com. Jeannie, I'm going to be told in a minute, I think, to get off here. What do you think about today's show? And is there something you want to add or refine?
I just think it's very, very important that we keep this discussion going. And I understand, and I actually talk about this in class. I call it the metaphorical tape on the mouth. We are so afraid in modern day America to offend anybody. We don't want to be politically incorrect. So what do? We put this metaphorical tape on our mouth. Well, actually, society puts it on our mouth, and we be quiet. And that's the very worst thing we can do. Let's have a dialogue why 90% of our sped kids are male. Let's have a dialogue why the majority of children who are taking psychiatric drugs are male. Let's have a dialogue about why our universities are predominantly female now. We've got to talk about this, and I know some people just, no, it's too politically explosive. We've got to gather all of our courage up and have this dialogue. We simply must.
I think so. I absolutely think so. And it would be interesting. I don't imagine that two people like us with these opinions would ever be invited onto a college campus today.
Well,
and we'd be in danger. We would be in danger.
I teach it one every day of my life. And I have to tell you, it's true. I just got the big award at the University of Nebraska at Kearney. We have a bunch of awards that, you know, professors pick and they vote for other professors. I didn't get that one. I got the student government one. We send out to all of our students a little ballot, and they vote for their senators. And at the bottom, it says, vote for the faculty member of the year that has most influenced you. I just won that award.
Folks, this is Professor Jeannie Stolzer, who just got the award of the year from the students. I didn't know that. What a great way to end. What a privilege for all of you to listen to her. What a privilege for me and Jeannie to be able to talk to you. Have a wonderful day. Hey, thanks, Jeannie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, dear.